Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the 8th episode of the Chemistry World Podcast with me, Azzy Kateri, sitting in for Chris Smith while he's enjoying the sunshine down under. But I'm joined by Chemistry World's editor, Mark Peplow.
Hello.
Deputy editor, Bea Perks.
Hello.
And science correspondents, Victoria Gill.
Hello.
And Richard Van Norden.
Hello.
This month, how nanoparticles help light up the MRI scan.
And the point of these nanoparticle contrast agents is that they're speeding up even more. So you just get this really marked improvement in contrast.
And how researchers were able to identify soft tissue in the fossilized remains of a 68-million-year-old T-Rex.
The evidence right now, to the best of our knowledge, supports the fact that some of the material in the bone matrix is collagen produced by the cells of the dinosaur.
And the quantum mechanics of green tea.
Because of this quantum tunneling, the beneficial reaction occurred so quickly that the lipids never really got a look in, thankfully.
That's all to come in the programme, but first, scientists at the Georgia Institute of Technology have developed a nanoscale power generator that can harvest electricity from the environment. The device relies on a combination of tiny nanowires and a specially designed electrode to transfer vibrations into electricity. Mark, tell us more about it.
Well, these are tiny generators that work on the scale of just billionths of a metre. Scientists for years have been working on various nanomachines, devices that work at this sort of scale, thousands of times smaller than the width of a human hair. But researchers lag behind on ways to actually power these machines. Now this group of scientists at the Georgia Institute of Technology have found a way that might work. Effectively what they've done is created, if you like, a tiny, tiny hairbrush where each of the bristles is made of what's called a nanowire, so a tiny thread, if you like, made out of zinc oxide. This chemical is piezoelectric, which means when you bend it, it actually creates a tiny electrical current. Now what they've done is taken this brush of zinc oxide nanowires, and over the top of it they have a corrugated surface made out of silicon coated with platinum. Now what they found is that just from background vibrations or ultrasonic waves, the movement of this corrugated surface across the nanowires, across this brush, actually makes them generate a current.
So how much power can they generate with their device at the moment?
Well, the current that they're outputting, appropriately enough, is nanoamps, so that's billionths of an amp. They reckon that there may be another 3 years of development in this before they're able to provide the sorts of powers that would be needed to actually power real-world devices.
So what sort of things could they use this device for?
Well, when we spoke to Zhonglin Wang, who leads this research team, he imagined that there was a variety of possible uses for this. Some of the ones that he was talking about was implantable biosensors that maybe monitor blood pressure or blood sugar levels, for example, if you're diabetic, or possibly even monitor for incidence of cancer, perhaps. He also suggested that there may be technical applications as well, for instance, remote sensing of gases or chemicals, or even, I mean, given that this is powered by ultrasonic waves, it could also prove to be a way of detecting ultrasonic waves if you wanted to do that.
Thanks, Mark. Now, from power-generating nanotechnology to even more nanotechnology, researchers in South Korea have used special nanoparticles as contrast agents in MRI or nuclear magnetic resonance imaging. As well as showing up unprecedented details in the image, these particles are also biocompatible. B.
Nanoparticles are being used to make clearer MRI images.
So how does MRI normally work then?
Well, the human body is about over 60% water, and each of the hydrogen ions in those water molecules has a magnetic moment. So in a very powerful magnetic field, the molecules line up, and in the scanner you have this enormously powerful magnetic field, but then you also have, running in the other direction, radio waves. And the radio waves reverse the magnetic field momentarily. You switch it on and off. And so these hydrogen ions, flipping backwards and forwards, they emit a little bit of radio frequency themselves. And that's what's picked up on the MRI scan. you see amazing detail, actually. But if depending on what you're looking for, you might want some more detail. And so there are these contrast agents that medics can use.
So what exactly is the role of the contrast agent? Because when we're talking about contrast, it's not like a photographic image contrast when it comes to MRI, is it?
No, absolutely not. And in an ordinary MRI scan, or at least an MRI scan without a contrast agent, what you're seeing is the hydrogen ions flipping between magnetic states. Once you put a contrast agent in there, you're speeding up that flipping. And it's the flipping that's being picked up, basically, on the image. And if you can speed that up, you're going to get a darker image, or a brighter image, perhaps I should say, but a stronger image anyway. And the point of these nanoparticle contrast agents is that they're speeding up even more. So you just get this really marked improvement in contrast. And there are already some contrast agents in use, and these are very successful, but some of them will cause kidney damage, for instance. And apparently, these nanoparticles get around that issue.
What are these nanoparticles actually made of?
These nanoparticles are manganese oxide, but they're coated in a biocompatible polyethylene glycol phospholipid shell. They've only used this in mice so far, I should say, so it's very early days. But if it does work in higher and higher animals and eventually in humans, then you'll be able to tell really slight differences, especially at the early stages, say, of neurological diseases, where you wouldn't see any damage with a conventional MRI scan.
Well, just out of curiosity, how big are the actual particles?
They are 25 nanometers across.
And do they get metabolised inside the body, or what actually happens to them once they're there?
No, they're not metabolised. They're safely excreted, so they don't do any damage to the body, or at least they didn't do any damage to these mice.
Well, from mice to dinosaurs now. A team of scientists have discovered extraordinary preservation of soft tissue in the remains of a 68-million-year-old Tyrannosaurus rex. The skull, vertebrae, femora and tibia of this dinosaur were recovered from the base of the Hell Creek Formation in eastern Montana in USA. Here's Dr. Mary Schweitzer of North Carolina State University.
We noticed exceptional preservation in this Tyrannosaurus rex fossil, and we reported the presence of four components that were not supposed to be present in dinosaur bone, and these would be the fibrous matrix that in modern bone is collagen, what appeared to be transparent blood vessels, and two cell populations.
That's really interesting, Mary, given that these fossils are quite old, aren't they?
Yes. This dinosaur was found at the very base of the Hell Creek Formation, which puts it at about 68 million years old, plus or minus 200,000.
Now, that's quite old for a piece of fossil. How is it that you found soft tissue in it?
Well, I found it by accident. And we're not really sure at the present why this material is preserved or how it's preserved or even what it is for sure. Just because it looks like vessels and cells does not mean that's what it is after 68 million years. Until our chemical analyses verify that these are products of the original cells of the original dinosaur, they could be anything. And at this point, that's where we're at, is trying to chemically and molecularly characterize these four different components.
So how are you trying to verify this?
By as many different means as possible, and we started with collagen, first of all, because in bone that's the most prevalent protein, and secondly, collagen is so well studied across all modern organisms that we know its characteristic fingerprints quite well. We needed to look for things like antibody binding, which is highly specific. We also did in situ localized mass spec, illustrating a lot of the amino acids in the tissues that are specific for collagen. We did atomic force microscopy to illustrate the cross-banding that's a hallmark of bone collagen, and then we finally did mass spec sequencing, which was part of the paper my colleague led.
So what have you concluded that these specimens actually are?
Well, the evidence right now, to the best of our knowledge, supports the fact that some of the material in the bone matrix is collagen produced by the cells of the dinosaur.
Why do you think the collagen in such an old specimen is still intact?
Well, we have a lot of different ideas, but one of the main paths that I'm working on right now is the role that iron may play in the preservation of this material. And the literature suggests that iron, under certain conditions, becomes very, very reactive and triggers the formation of a lot of protein crosslinks. If the cross links are in the right place and of the right type, it basically removes the active sites of the molecule that enzymes can attack. It protects them. What we found in our studies is that bone provides a large degree of protection from different degradative processes that skin and muscles and guts don't have. So I think, you know, the first component in preservation is the fact that this material is bone.
Now, if I can turn to the co-author, Dr. John Asara from the Harvard Medical School. John, how does your work link in with what Dr. Schweitzer has been doing?
She has actually shown that the T-Rex fossil is exceptionally well preserved and contains soft tissues. Then basically what we did was we attempted to actually find peptide sequences in the T-Rex fossil, and it was a real struggle. There was very, very little peptidic material to actually begin with. When we got the bone extract from her, it was more than 99.99% some sort of brown, gritty contaminant, and we actually needed to use a lot of purification and a lot of chromatographic techniques in order to remove the contaminants from the actual peptide content. And when we were actually successful at that, we got 7 total peptide sequences, and these sequences barely crossed the detection level of the mass spectrometer.
How did you overcome that problem?
What we had to do was basically take all of what she had given us, which is about 30 to 40 milligrams, and we had to purify all of that and concentrate it down to a few microliters of material. And when we injected those few microliters, we were able to actually get enough signal to successfully sequence pieces of the collagen protein. And then when we get the sequences, we can then search them against a protein database.
How did you know that what you were looking at was actually remains of a 68-million-year-old species? Because there wouldn't really be any indication of what this species should look like in the database. How did you overcome that problem?
What we have to do is rely on matches of related species. So if you had, let's say, a common contaminant, let's say we were really sequencing a chicken bone, well, then all of the sequences that we obtain would match chicken collagen. If, let's say, we were sequencing a frog and not a T-Rex, then all of our sequences would then align perfectly with frog. But the fact is we got 7 sequences, 3 which matched uniquely to chicken, and then we got 2 which matched multiple organisms. But then we got these 2 very interesting sequences, one that only matched newt. Nothing else in the database had the sequence except for newt. And then we got the same thing for frog. So that's how we knew that it was likely not frog, likely not newt, and it was likely not chicken because of these unique newt and also these unique frog sequences, and the fact that we were getting almost barely enough material to actually cross the threshold of the mass spectrometer. If you had any sort of contamination, even the smallest amount that you can barely see of modern collagen, it would overwhelm the instrument in terms of sensitivity. So when you put all these factors together, especially the sequence alignment, that's the nail in the coffin here, overall picture was clear that it was from T-Rex and obviously not a modern contaminant. And the thing is, things like newts were never native to the Hell Creek environment, so there's almost no way that you could really make a case for contamination.
So when you were looking at these T-Rex proteins, you were finding sequences that matched with chicken, some with frog and some with newt. So how would you then be able to distinguish that it's not another species, but specifically a T-Rex?
So you're saying that maybe this bone was from something that we don't know about that's not T-Rex, but sort of also matched all of these things uniquely, the way that we had it all lined up. I guess Mary and also Jack Horner know, based on the structure of the bones, the size of the bones, where they come from, that it's got to be a T-Rex. And certainly nothing smaller. Don't forget that this was a huge femur bone that actually needed to be broken in order to put inside a helicopter. So I don't think, when you take into account the shape and all of their experiences, I don't think there's any question that it was actually a T-Rex.
What do you think these findings will actually show us? How will they help us in the future?
The biggest thing that you can get from this is now we have established a methodology that we can use to actually probe proteins from extinct organisms. And if we acquire sequences from these extinct organisms, even if it's only from collagen, you can start to make evolutionary relationships based on sequence. And we can start to maybe fit these extinct organisms better in evolution.
Dr. John Asara, on how the team have managed to sequence the oldest ever protein specimen. On the way, how traditional Chinese medicine may provide a safe alternative to hormone replacement therapy, and how quantum mechanics can explain the beneficial effects of green tea. But first, the case of a disappearing sunset. Richard, tell us more.
Well, if I can just sort of digress on the chemistry conversation a bit to tell you about art. Winslow Homer is a very famous American painter. I hadn't heard of him before I stumbled across this little bit of research. But the Art Institute at Chicago have, in fact, they're launching a major exhibition of his work in spring 2008. Homer painted some paintings, including a lot of pastoral scenes. One of them, for example, For to Be a Farmer's Boy, which I'll attempt to describe, but obviously you can see it on our website. It's a little farmer's boy in a pumpkin field, and there's a white sky behind him. But when researchers looked at the painting, they realised that invisible to the naked eye, but just visible under the microscope, were tiny orange and red dye pigments, which probably meant that the original white sky was in fact a sunset. Unfortunately, the original dyes that Winslow Homer used were unstable in light and very quickly degraded, leaving almost nothing.
When you say very quickly, how long are we actually talking?
Well, he painted around the 19th century, so of course we're talking about 100 years. And obviously they've been kept in reduced light levels, but within 20 years they would have degraded to almost nothing.
So what's the dye actually made of?
The dye known as red lac pigments, and it's made by precipitating an organic dye stuff like madder or cochineal from insects onto some kind of inorganic binder like chalk or alumina. And it's those kind of dye stuffs which UV light breaks down.
So what are these researchers trying to do at the moment?
Well, normally what a chemist would do to work out what a dye is Raman spectroscopy, which is the kind of you fire a certain wavelength of light at your sample of interest and some of the light scatters off, different wavelengths scattering off in different directions, and that would just sort of give you a fingerprint that you could compare to a known substance. Unfortunately, these organic dyes have been very little studied, and one reason is that they're extremely fluorescent, and that just completely swamps the signal for traditional Raman spectroscopy. And to make things worse, these dyes aren't really available now because painters just don't use them.
So if Raman spectroscopy isn't going to work, what other techniques can they use?
Fortunately, a technique called surface-enhanced Raman spectroscopy. In surface-enhanced Raman spectroscopy, you put your dye molecules, for example, on a substrate of silver nanoparticles, which are on top of some kind of alumina spheres, and plasmon resonances, which are electron waves excited on the surface when you shine your laser light in, they resonate and improve the signal. So what they've got to do, they've got to build up a library of these pigments. They've got to say, you know, cochineal normally looks like this under surface enhanced Raman spectrum, madder looks like this, Brazilwood looks like this. Then they have to somehow work out a way of taking the red pigments off the painting, comparing them to their library, and hopefully recreating what the sunsets would have looked like.
Now, from disappearing sunsets to disappearing memories, researchers have identified a potential target for a memory-enhancing drug. Victoria.
This is some research that's come out of the University of Montreal. Nahum Sonnenberg and his team have engineered a genetic knockout mouse that can't phosphorylate this particular protein called ELF2-alpha. And ELF2-alpha stimulates the production of a new protein that prevents the making of new memories. So you need certain proteins to build memories, to strengthen synapses, the junctions between your neurons, and certain proteins that inhibit the production of new memories. And so the phosphorylation of ELF2-alpha inhibits the formation of new memories.
So does that mean that they've effectively found the way of stopping memories being made?
Yeah, they tested their mouse with a molecule that increases the phosphorylation of ELF2-alpha. So what they basically have is a drug that makes the smarter mouse forget. So the opposite of what they would want to achieve with the potential memory-enhancing drug. The idea being that because they have a molecule that does this, then technically you can get a molecule that does the opposite, and that would be your memory-enhancing drug.
Does this actually mean that one day we might be able to buy a bottle of memory-enhancing pills, just like some people might do with vitamin supplements?
There's been lots of speculation about the idea of being able to improve our memories and improve our learning ability. But from the perspective of these researchers, this is a potential medical treatment. So you have neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's that affect your memory, particularly Alzheimer's disease. So the idea would be to have a molecule that you could give to patients to stop them from suffering this quite debilitating memory loss.
Thanks, Victoria. Now, from time to time, traditional botanical remedies are investigated for their beneficial properties for use in conventional medicine. Professor Young of the National University of Singapore is researching commonly used Chinese herbs in the hope of developing safer alternative drugs for the treatment of menopausal symptoms.
Menopausal women traditionally take synthetic estrogens to relieve their symptoms and to improve their bone health. But in recent years, the common preparations for hormone replacement therapy have been shown to cause an increase in adverse effects like breast cancer, strokes, cardiovascular disease, and even increased incidence of Alzheimer's disease. So a lot of women worldwide have stopped taking this traditional hormone replacement therapy, and they are increasingly turning to botanicals. The problem there with botanicals or herbal extracts is that there's very little data on bioavailability, on how they act, and whether they are actually safe and efficacious. So I wanted to examine in a very scientific way whether these botanical alternatives are really efficacious and safe.
So what types of plants have you been looking at?
We examined about 24 plants and found that a particular plant called Epimedium has a high concentration of prenylated flavonoids. And now flavonoids are the chemicals that give plants its color, and traditionally they protect the plants against fungal infection, among other things. But flavonoids have recently been shown to have quite favorable effects on various cell systems. For example, the flavonoid from the soya bean has been reported to improve cholesterol levels if you take them in high enough quantities. Now, this particular flavonoid from Epimedium is special in that it has a prenyl chain and may improve the bioavailability. And also, it has a furan group, which makes it a very strong estrogen receptor alpha activator.
So what exactly is Epimedium, and what does it look like?
Intriguingly, this is a wild plant grown in various parts of China. If you want a description, it's a little shrub that has three stems, and the three stems will have three little leaflets. And the three little branch stems will bear a leaf with three leaflets, you see. So it's three plus three plus three. It's a very beautiful plant. The colloquial name in Chinese is Yin Yang Huo. In the web, it's sold as horny goat weed. And that's exactly what Yin Yang Huo means in Chinese. Now, the reason why it's called horny goat weed is that apparently goats in the field were feeding on this particular weed. Epimedium became very sexually aroused and sold on the web as the male Viagra. So these compounds are quite complex because besides being estrogenic, they can activate other systems, you see, and that's the fascination of natural compounds.
So now that you're identifying active ingredients in these plants, what is the next step?
Plant extract is a bit like a wine. You have various wines, cheap wines, good wines, some are high alcoholic content, some are bitter, some have tannins. And so what we wanted to do was to have the highest quality possible botanical extract. So we need to know the species, like whether it's a Bordeaux or whether it's a Champagne. And we need to know whether it's Chateau Lafite, where it's grown, and under what conditions it's harvested and prepared. And we wanted the chemical content to be known, like tannin content, alcohol content, in the case of wine. So we wanted to do it for the herb, so that we have a standardized, high-quality preparation. And we are doing it with a European company. So once we have that standardized preparation, we will be then in the position to put in animals. And we have found that actually the chemicals and the activity is present in sufficient concentrations for us to expect a biological effect. And then the final step will be to translate that to the human. So we will be doing that very shortly.
Professor Yu Long Yong from the National University of Singapore. Now, staying with the Far East, we have even more news for you. Mark, tell us more.
That's right. While we have various scientists investigating traditional Chinese medicine, as we've just been hearing about, over in China, there's an ongoing bribery and corruption scandal dogging their State Food and Drug Administration. The former head of this Food and Drug Administration, Zheng Shiyu, was detained on corruption charges back in December. This month, some more details about this case have emerged, and essentially it's been widely reported that he's been taking bribes from various Chinese pharmaceutical companies to approve their medicines, shepherd them through the approval process.
So what exactly is the Food and Drug Administration doing about this issue?
Well, they have a new head in place, Xiao Liming, who told our reporter in late March that his agency is now revising the drug registration regulations to try and tighten up the criteria for new drugs. One of the interesting things is that it's been very, very easy for Chinese pharmaceutical companies in the past, through this process, to get drugs approved as new, in inverted commas, whereas in fact there may really be very little novel about those drugs at all. So that's part of the process which is likely to be tightened up. And that's something actually that's going to be welcomed by the increasing number of international pharmaceutical companies that are setting up bases in China and starting to collaborate with scientists out there.
Of course, this issue is important for pharmaceutical companies because they have patents to protect. But how does it actually affect people? And are there any indications of safety margins being sacrificed with these new drugs?
This is obviously extremely important to the people of China who are taking drugs that have been approved by this agency, because if a drug is classified as new, the company is basically able to price it in a different way, which effectively means that they can make more profits from these things. But there haven't necessarily been the checks and balances that one would expect in assessing that they are completely safe for medical use. And there's now an enormous investigation to go back and recheck about more than 100,000 drugs that were approved between 1999 and 2002.
Well, we hope no one is adversely affected by these drugs. Now, Richard, what is this about quantum effects and green tea?
Yeah, well, of course, quantum effects are at the core of everything, but they are also at the core of green tea, and scientists have used quantum mechanics to work out why green tea is good for you. Green tea has always been associated with good health and long life, and that's because it contains chemicals called catechins, or possibly catechins, depending on how you want to say them. But anyway, they act as antioxidants, and they disrupt a damaging chain reaction that can happen between free radicals in your body and lipids. Now, we knew about that before. So now, Ángels González Lafont and her colleagues at the University of Barcelona in Spain, they've worked out why green tea catechins can mop up the free radicals. And it seems that it's all down to a quantum effect called quantum tunnelling.
So what exactly is quantum tunnelling?
Right, well, quantum tunnelling can help quantum particles like an electron overcome energy barriers that you would think would be completely insurmountable. It relies on the idea that particles can also behave like waves. So a particle that is an electron has a spread out waveform associated with it, and the waveform kind of tells you the probability of where the electron might be. If the waveform extends to the other side of a barrier, there's a probability that the particle could pop up on the other side of the barrier, as if it had just sort of gone straight through a wall.
So how does quantum tunnelling relate to green tea?
Well, what González Lafont groups found was that when the catechins mop up free radicals, the crucial step is for the free radicals to nick a hydrogen atom from the catechin, which effectively neutralises the free radicals' reactivity. And they calculated that the complex between catechin and the free radical was so tight and compact that quantum tunnelling could occur between the two compounds, so electron density could move between the two compounds in such a way that the hydrogen atom could very quickly be extracted and put onto the free radical. Now, this meant that the other reaction, where you'll remember the free radical damaging the lipids, the rate of that would normally perhaps compete slightly with the catechin mopping up the free radical. But because of this quantum tunnelling, the beneficial reaction occurred so quickly that the lipids never really got a look in, thankfully. So quantum tunnelling explained why the catechin reacted so fast with the free radicals, and we should all be thankful for it.
So there you have it. More tea for everyone, that's what I say. Now, what news do we have from our competition, Victoria?
Well, last month, last podcast, we launched a competition to ask our listeners what they thought was the most rubbish or most useless element. The prize is a set of top trumps, periodic table top trumps, one of the criterion being usefulness of the element. So we asked people to send in their suggestions, 50 words or less, and the winner is Lawrence Smallman from Qatar. He wrote us a poem. Congratulations, Lawrence, and there's a set of top trumps winging their way to you.
The winning entry, as Victoria mentioned, is a poem about the nominated element. And here's Dr. Stéphane Garcelon from the Chemistry Department in the University of Cambridge, who has kindly agreed to read it for us.
Francium. When it comes to rubbish elements, francium takes the biscuit. Its longest living isotopes won't endure 50 minutes. When it comes to rubbish elements, francium is a mess. It hardly occurs naturally, just 30 grams or less. But should rationality not convince you, let me try a second tack. Francium has a Gallic link, so it really must be crap.
Thank you very much, Stéphane. Now, the question we'd like you to ponder on for this month is, why does wine cork? Send us your answers to chemistryworld@rsc.org, and you have until next month's podcast to enter. Well, that's it for this month. This podcast was produced and presented by me, Azzy Kateri, from thenakedscientists.com, and Chemistry World editor Mark Peplow, deputy editor Bea Perks, and science correspondents Victoria Gill and Richard Van Norden. For more science, do check out the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org. And until next month, from all of us here, goodbye.